Hello, everyone, and thank you for joining us today on State of Our Workforce. Each month, we take a journey together into the heart of workforce innovation and explore how to build an equitable workforce. My name is Michelle Wilson, and I am the Director of Evaluation and Learning at the National Fund. Our series, as you know, if you've been following along with us, is looking at focusing on the anthropology of work. Again, if we understand anthropology to mean the study of humans, we are looking at humans at work. And so I also just want to acknowledge and honor that we are celebrating this month, AAPI month, Asian American Pacific Islander Heritage Month. And so in honor of that, we have invited Josie Howard, CEO of We Are Oceana. Josie is connected to us through our Hawaii collaborative. And so I'm super excited. Josie, super smart. We could probably talk all day, so we're about to get into a conversation. And just a forewarning that this is a free-flowing conversation because there's so much to learn and engage with her on. So hi, Josie, how are you?
Hi, Michelle. I'm fine, thank you. I don't know about super smart, but
yeah.
I love to talk stories.
Yes. Well, that's not easy to do. So you ready to dig in?
Yes, definitely. Okay.
So just a little frame, one of the things that we've been talking about that we always talk about in workforce development and certainly something that we talk about at the National Fund is the importance of disaggregated data and what to do with that data once it's disaggregated. I'm especially talking about deeply disaggregated data. And I think Josie and the work that they're doing is rooted around this. So I just want to start our conversation around insights when you talk about Micronesian migrants and unique challenges and the role that data plays in that. But some of the challenges, what you've learned about some of the challenges that folks face when seeking employment in the space.
Well, thank you so much for this opportunity. You know, when we talk about disaggregated data or just data, and you're talking about Micronesians, you know, Micronesia means small islands, right? So we're talking about a really small number of people. That's not to me. I always think like there's a lot of us. But what the challenge of that is really like it's so easy for us to fall through the crack because mm-hmm. it's such a small number. And mm-hmm. even on the census, you know, you go to fill out the census and you are labeled among other Pacific Islanders, right? And then you have an opportunity to write in where you come from. So that, but one thing that I want to do is like, you know, to back up to really understand we may be a small place, we may be small islands, but Micronesia, it's very diverse culturally, environmentally, economically, and linguistically. Mm-hmm. There are about 15 languages in Micronesia and other sub dialects of those languages. So like, for example, I come from Chuuk in Micronesia, but my dialect, it's very unique to the western part of Chuuk. So when I speak to Chuuk from the center, I have to speak their dialect in order for them to understand. And in order for me to speak to other Micronesians, I have to speak English because that's the national language in Micronesia. Economically, you know, I want to also make this because there's a lot of the times people think that Micronesia is just one place. You know, there's centers, and I call them centers. I think we can think of them as cities like Honolulu. And there are rural areas. Like I come from the most remote part in Micronesia or in Chuuk State. And just like if we were to think about Honolulu, and then now you think about Waipio Valley on the Big Island, you know, so that's very diverse. And environmentally, you know, we have islands that have mountains, and we also have islands that have are just atolls, sand islands. Right. Yeah, so the resources are very, you know, different. Yes.
So thank you for providing that framing for that, because just in you recounting that, the number of challenges that you may encounter in developing equitable workforce solutions for folks, is vast, right? So like that to me is a one big takeaway around that. I'm also curious, you know, in addition to talking about this aggregated data, one of the other areas that we really like to dig into, particularly when we talk around inequities, is around like the drivers of those things, because I imagine, and we'll talk about this because we talked about climate change and how that's impacting workforce, but there's a whole other big like elephant in the room around Micronesian culture, and that's the role of colonialism. And so I just invite you to speak a little bit about that.
Yes, Micronesia has gone through four colonial powers, Spain, Germany, Japan, and we say the United States. Until today, we are, you know, with the relationship, and, you know, prior to that, the trust territory. So there is that we also have to deal with that has impacted our health. You know, I'm not one that can really speak a lot about the nuclear testing because I'm not from the Marshall Islands, but I am aware that, you know, the health issues that we're faced with has a lot to do with our colonial history, you know, what happened in our areas. World War II happened in our backyard, in all over Micronesia. So with the colonial history of Micronesia, it really had reshaped and had also impact our migration. That's part of the reason why there's a lot of people who are migrating. And of course, we talked about climate change. You know, I talked about the islands being, some of these islands are just 4 to 6 feet above sea level, like where I come from. So climate change is real. It's a real issue. Not everybody think they're migrating because of climate change, because a lot of people will say, you know, I'm looking for more resources. People are moving because the resources are not as much, you know, the trees are not producing, like coconut trees is one of our staple. They're not producing as much fruit, or sometimes empty, no water inside. And our taros are dying because of the rising salty, you know, salt sea level. I think also with the colonial history, what that really has done is it had really destructed our traditional governing system. Yeah. And I also want to speak to a little bit about just like kind of explain that in Micronesia until today, there's still two ways of living there. Like people who live in the city, they may live off money, you know, they depend on people who go to work. And for people who live out in the rural area, like where I come from, they really live off the land still, and they live off the ocean. So they depend on that for their daily life, their daily, you know, stables. So when we talk about the workforce, there's really no work on the islands that we come, like where I come from, there's probably maybe a good 12 or 20 people that have a job, and the bigger employer is the government. So there's teachers or maybe a medic on the island, but everybody else is living off the land and the ocean. And as we move toward the center, and that's a little bit different, you know, because there's more opportunities in the center, there's more jobs, and there's more resources.
So given what you're saying, and again, I just want to go back and hold the frame around how data is able to kind of highlight or lift up some of these challenges, right? And I think there's another question we'll get to. I want to draw a through line for around how people not identify climate change, but you know it's climate change, but the importance and the role of research in this, but the right kind of research in these particular communities. But the workforce piece too. So I'm curious about what your role is in your organization, We Are Oceana, in navigating those challenges and helping folks become employed in places given the migration patterns and all of those things. Can you speak a little bit about that?
Yes. So understanding the background of where people come from, understanding their, you know, colonial history, culture, everything that I just talked about, really helped in shaping our framework on how we work with them and also how we help them succeed to find jobs and also help our partners, the employers, to understand how to work better with our people. And we sometimes provide cultural training so that they understand everything, like just the basic. We talk about our geography. We talk about history. We talk about our cultural values and then the challenges and some of those things to help employers to kind of gain that deeper understanding so that they can also influence, you know, like how they work with our population.
So what, I mean, going back, you spoke a little bit about the colonial history, and in my mind that automatically brings up issues of racism that probably live and exist and really ripe in your communities. But that, so I'm holding that, but I'm also thinking about employers and how they engage or how they respond to creating workspaces that are in sync with cultural and community values.
So I can speak to some of the experiences that I had and some of the stories that I had or I have. You know, so the first step is like helping them to understand who we are, helping them to understand. And that's really, it's the act of building relationship. We have partnership with over 150 organizations. And part of that is to build the relationship. And so helping them to understand our folks, and then they take it. And we continue to nurture that relationship by kind of like staying to support them with their strategies. Like, for example, at one of the where I used to work before, you know, we educate the managers on how to work better with our folks. And sometimes there's maybe a couple of workers or employees will ask for a day off. And the manager realized that, wait, this is like too many employees asking for a day off at the same time on the same day. And then instead of like saying, no, you cannot do that, the manager, they get upon him or herself to come back or like contact us and say, hey, I have this situation. Do you know if there's anything going on? Most of the time, there's something going on, like there's a funeral, there's a wedding or a graduation, but especially funeral. And so then I'll, you know, explain to the manager, there's this going on. And then the manager will be like, okay. And then the manager will work on another option, like scheduling people to take off at certain time, not everybody at the same time, but allowing them to still participate in the event that is so important to them or to their community, because after work, they go back to the community, they go back to the family, and that's their security, that's their support system that is so important for them to sustain or to keep or to make that relationship right. And I have most of the time, like not once, not twice, not three times, people have told me, I can always find another job, but I cannot find another family. And that's just how important that value is, that it really helps us to understand how do we work to help them, you know, like succeed at work, because they're really great workers. Once they work, a lot of the managers that we work with or the employers, they talk highly of how these people have, or like our folks had really contributed to the success of the company. Like at this one company that I worked with before, where they hire a lot of our females to sort donations and, you know, like tag donations. And was for the first time the company made $1 million in a month.
Wow.
And their production was, I think, three times higher than usual. Wow. And it was the same number of people. Yes.
Well, and so, again, what's so important about that, and I mean, we talk about it all the time, but it's really lovely to hear you lift up these examples, is that when you, as an employer, lean into your community in a real way and you value your employees and humanize them in a way that they know that they matter and that you believe that they matter, what that does for the bottom line for all, right? Which is really what I hear you lifting up. I think, again, so I want to talk a little bit. I'm not sure how many people are, and this is AIPI month, so we are in the space of education for folks who may or may not be familiar. And again, we're only here for like 20, 30 minutes. Like this is a lifetime of learning. So we're talking a lot into a short bit of space, right? Talk about, share with us the work agreements that exist in Micronesia and the U.S., like the around COFA and things like that. Can you explain what COFA is and then talk a little bit about that?
Okay, I'll do my best. So COFA stands for Compact of Free Association. COFA is actually a treaty. So that's why I don't like to use the term COFA.
Okay.
I don't want to say COFA citizen because that's not right. Okay. And I rather use FAS citizen. FAS is Freely Associated States. And that would refer to the Republic of Palau, mm-hmm. Republic of the Marshall Islands, and the Federated States of Micronesia. So these three nations have Compact of Free Association Treaty with the United mm-hmm. States. Mm-hmm. Each treaty is a little bit unique, but you know they share the basic, which this treaty is to have us access United States, or we can come in and out of United States as we want. We don't have to have visa like we used to do before. We can come in and work and go to school. You know, there's no 4 years education in Micronesia. I think for the first time, maybe a couple of years ago or 4 years ago, Chaminade Extension started in Chuuk. And I think the community colleges now are going on to 4 years. But during my time, there's no 4 years. Mm-hmm. So we have to come out to, you know, further our education. So that's one of the things under the compact. And of course, when we come out to the United States, we are legal to work. We're probably the most legal, migrants into the United States. But that also gives United States the full control of our nation, denial mm-hmm. right to any other foreign countries like Japan, China, Russia, mm-hmm. To have any military relationship or any military activities in the area. Mm-hmm. And given the United States sole control of our land, air, and ocean for military, our really strategic. What else can I say about that? We do have diplomatic relationship with other countries. Mm-hmm. You know, so we have embassies in Japan, we have embassy in China, we have embassy in Australia, Fiji, mm-hmm. So we can have diplomatic relationship. We're politically independent, but financially dependent on the United States. So that's what the compact also entails. So for every certain years, the United States agrees to this certain amount of money given to us to operate our government, you know, to be able to. And at the same time, we're building our infrastructure, sure. our economy to be able to operate as a nation. So we are a member of the United Nations. We do vote for climate change and those kind of things that mm-hmm. the United Nations does. Yes.
So, I mean, so this brings up for me. So one, I mean, I want to have a conversation about, again, what skill building looks like in your communities, given the challenges that you have. But I'm curious, and we haven't talked about this previously, what that looks like, or what is it, challenges people from Micronesians face when they enter the United States mainland, or they're in the mainland space, right? Like, it's one thing to be in community and have an employer respond to your needs, right, in that little niche community, but what does it look like in settings where that's not available. I'm just, I can imagine that can be disconcerting.
No, mm-hmm. Thank you for the question. Mm-hmm. Thank you for the question. It can be tough. A lot of the times I see our people being taken advantage of. Mm-hmm. I had to help individuals who, you know, who were abused by their supervisors just because they don't know their rights, mm-hmm. Their rights at work, you know, mm-hmm. like what is an employee's right? They don't understand that. And also with the limited English, you know, a lot of our folks get taken advantage of. A lot of our folks don't get paid check. They get paid on, you know, cash. So they don't have access to benefits, those kind of things when they're treated like that. Mm-hmm. Yeah, so that can be really disadvantaged. And we've seen cases with like meat factories in the mainland. During COVID, there was those cases where our people were treated so badly and there was a spread of COVID at the workplace. We get to deal with those individuals. And there was also at one point, a lot of our young women and men were recruited to come out for nursing schools. But what they didn't know was that they were actually taking them to work at nursing homes and they were not nursing schools. Mm-hmm. But, you know, because of the cultural gap, mm-hmm. You know, it really, it's hard. And so it's a huge job, even for our government to start getting involved with that. And I think they did with that one particular situation where mm-hmm. there's a lot of our folks that were just recruited throughout mm-hmm. the whole state, like all the way even to Maine, mm-hmm. you know, mm-hmm. and New Hampshire, and all the way to Florida or Georgia. Those are states that... you know, normally it's hard to go to because they're far away. But yeah, our people get to get recruited. And there's a lot of people who come in country to recruit out. And there's a need to have an education mm-hmm. or like educational class. I call it acculturation. Mm-hmm. Yes, acculturation. And that's an anthropology term.
Yes, it is.
I love it. Yeah. And one thing I love about acculturation is because, you know, to honor others, you don't want to for them to change their ways just because.
Exactly.
So I'd rather use it than the word assimilation, because assimilation is taking on the dominant. Yeah. So acculturation, you still have your culture you come with. You now learn a new culture. You become even richer and you become even more equipped when you have both cultures.
Right. And it's what we really talk about is particularly when you're doing race equity work, it's like, how do you show up in the workplace as your full self, right? Like, how do you accept a whole of me rather than the part that makes you comfortable or that you know or that you're familiar with and something to there. Again, I mean, I think we probably need to start wrapping up and have a couple more questions for you. But I think what I appreciate about this conversation and why I just love chatting with you about this, like this brings up so much around the work that we do around the National Fund, around race equity, around workers' rights, worker voice, upskilling, disaggregated data, all of those things come into play. But I want to move into the upskilling piece because you talked about folks who live off money or folks who live off the land. And if folks are moving from one location to the other, if you're used to living off of the land, obviously there's skill, deep skill involved in that. But how do you extract those skills in a way that serve folks who are looking for employment? So,
I love this question because this is the question that I'm always excited about. You know, when you ask me that question or when I think about that question, I think about Papa Mau, mm-hmm. Papa Mau Bialik. Mm-hmm. You know, a lot of these people come with skills, come with, I call them innovations. Mm-hmm. Like they hold some of the skills that are keys to success today, to mm-hmm. innovation today. Mm-hmm. It's just that we have not highlighted. And that's one of the framework that we employ here at WOW. We want to look at people's strengths mm-hmm. and mm-hmm. we want to look at their asset and we want to see how can we acculturate this to mainstream and how can we weave it so that we can build a even more robust. And I'm talking with a big smile on my face because I feel like COVID gave us that opportunity to mm-hmm. see the impossible, mm-hmm. right? The state closed down. There was no way for people to go to the grocery store. Like all the things that are convenience, mm-hmm. they were not available to us. Now we had to like rely on skills, life skills, to be able to survive. A lot of these people, a lot of my people have those with them, and mm-hmm. they are great asset. And it's just a matter of finding out and how do we take this out and how do we weave them into mm-hmm. what we do today. Mm-hmm. And I think we are Oceania, being part of the workforce Good Job Challenge, mm-hmm. you know, here in Hawaii, had really allowed us to kind of like also share some of our knowledge or mm-hmm. share some of those with the key people that are working on this. But our hope is that this is not just benefiting to the participants of Good Job Challenge, but the whole state and hopefully, you know, the whole America, because yeah. this is recognizing not just Micronesians, but Indigenous people. We come with life skills.
Yeah. Yes. Yeah. I knew this was going to happen. I have so many more questions and I want to talk so much more about this, but we are running out of time, but I do want to leave with having you tell us and share with us, what are you most excited about as you think about the future of your organization and your people and your cult? Just tell me. Please tell me.
I think I am so excited about the youths that we work with. You know, in the work that we have been doing for the community, we have not intentionally like done leadership training, mm-hmm. but through this work that we've done with the youths, we have seen leaders emerging. Yeah. And that, to me, that is hope. That's right. Exactly what we wanted. And like, and these are the cultural frameworks that we're using that I just get so amazed with the fact that these frameworks were so brilliant. They were done in a way that we don't have to say, you know what, we're going to have a leadership training. They rise up to it.
Yes.
Because naturally they rise up to it. And that is yes. the most beautiful thing that you want to see in a human being.
Right.
Yes.
Right.
So that's what I'm excited about.
Wow. I'm sorry we have to end this conversation, but you and I can continue talking and I want to learn more around the work that you're doing there. So we'll end here, but there's so much more to learn. If you enjoyed this conversation, again, if you want to hear it, you can listen to it on our podcast. I want to thank Josie for joining us today. I want to thank everyone who joined us in the audience on LinkedIn. So again, please make sure to follow the National Fund on LinkedIn to stay up to date with all the latest on State of Our Workforce. Please make sure to tune in next month as we continue the conversation on the anthropology of work. Take good care.
Thank you so much.
State of Our Workforce is a production of the National Fund for Workforce Solutions. This episode was produced by Josh Enoch. The music in this episode is produced by Alex Productions. You can find past episodes of State of Our Workforce on our website at www.nationalfund.org. State of Our Workforce is also available on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, or wherever you may listen. State of Our Workforce airs live monthly on LinkedIn. Follow the National Fund for Workforce Solutions on LinkedIn to get updates about the next live recording of State of Our Workforce.